Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be looking at the temporary suspension of foreign aid by the Trump administration, and particularly looking at its impact on Africa. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Natasha Lindstedt, a professor of government and Director of Education at the University of Essex. Natasha, I'm very, very pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, so on the first day of President Trump's second term presidency, one of the executive orders that he signed was the temporary freezing of aid, foreign aid. And we know Africa benefits a lot or receives a lot of foreign aid from that. So I wanted to start by looking at the implication of that for African countries that depend heavily on foreign aid.
Right. I mean, I think that it will be actually African countries that will be the most badly affected. As you mentioned, you know, the U.S. does spend a lot of money on foreign aid. Last year, or in 2023, they spent somewhere around $72 billion on foreign aid, if you're not counting military forms of aid. And Africa in particular is a major recipient of that. But I think what we're really looking at is the impact on the loss of some of these healthcare programs. I mean, it should have a devastating effect on the health of millions of Africans who are relying on these pre-existing programs. It wasn't as if these was something that was sort of phased out, that there were years and years of planning about how to phase this out. It was done really abruptly and without any kind of warning. And so where, if you just look at USAID, USAID in particular, that used to have hundreds of staff, they've been whittled down to maybe 12 people, I think, in all of Africa, 8 in Latin America, and something like 21 in the Middle East and all of Asia. So that's a really drastic cut in the number of staff. And then, of course, a huge suspension in these life-saving programs that are really vital, whether they be addressing HIV/AIDS or malaria, tuberculosis, Ebola, Mpox, Marburg virus. I mean, there's a long list of implications here.
I'll come back to the implications, but I think we should start first from the history of AIDS and start from the end of the Second World War. Look at the Marshall Plan and look at the motivation behind aid to Europe, aid to Asia, and aid to Africa. So do we see such kind of a reconfiguration of, because in my work, in the literature, we look at aid to Europe could be, helping allies. Helping, an Europe that's been badly battered by, by the war. And then we look at the, in Africa, we look at, maybe to check, maybe the competition between the superpowers, between the former Soviet Union, and then to just check that community. Do we see similar thing happening here with Trump's action? Is it an attempt to reconfigure some kind of world order? I don't know.
Well, Trump definitely has a America First agenda that is a departure from past administrations. that wanted to build alliances a little bit more and saw things in terms of the long view. I mean, you mentioned the Marshall Plan, and that was probably one of the most successful American initiatives to rebuild Europe so that there would be a reliable trading partner, that there'd be mutually beneficial relationships, and that they would become economically interdependent, build democracy, and the world would be safer and stronger. So the Marshall Plan was largely this very successful, positive initiative. Some of the aid that the US and other donors have given to Africa and Latin America, for example, they weren't always necessarily motivated by the same types of things that you see with the Marshall Plan. A lot of the aid to Africa was actually military aid and was part of the Cold War to stem off Soviet influence. A lot of the aid was given to personalist regimes that were basically siphoning off that aid and then leaving some of these countries in odious, like with odious debt. So it's not so much a benign picture as with the Marshall Plan. I mean, I think that aid can be really, really helpful, particularly the aid that is targeting some specific areas such as health and development of infrastructure and so forth. But a lot of the aid that went to Africa and Latin America during the Cold War was really just military aid, and then also ended up saddling these countries with so much debt.
We'll come back to that in a minute. You did mention you did single out the health sector and how this impacts health sector. I've recently seen, I think in South Africa, we've seen South Africa has also been singled out by Trump in terms of like the funding. I'm seeing how the HIV program has been kind of like affected, and Trump also withdrawing from the World Health Organization as well. So I wanted you to like speak on the scope of the impact of these, and maybe look at countries that are most affected in Africa. And how,
right. So, the withdrawal from the World Health Organization, which just came with really no warning. I mean, he was threatening to do it during his last administration when he didn't like what the World Health Organization was saying. But this is going to have a huge impact because the U.S. provides 18% of the agency's total funding. And the World Health Organization is really critical to going through all kinds of scientific research and then providing policies and guidelines that countries, particularly in Africa, are adhering to, that they rely upon. And there's also all kinds of programs that are in place that the World Health Organization props up and sets up. So this, coupled with the gutting of USAID, is catastrophic, as I've already mentioned. It's such a big impact on health, particularly because you had, for example, vaccination programs, which are critical to saving millions of lives. These will be halted. I mean, they made huge strides in the malaria vaccine. Malaria kills under 500,000, somewhere around 450,000 to 500,000 under fives each year. And the work that had been done by USAID in partnership with other organizations had helped to save some 8 million lives. You have tuberculosis, which is a disease that kills over a million people per year, and has become more deadly in some ways as there's strains that are resistant to antibiotics. The work of USAID was really critical to saving somewhere between 79 to 80 million lives. And then of course you have the work with PEPFAR, which actually was an initiative of the Bush administration, an administration I'm usually really critical of. And the rationale behind PEPFAR wasn't necessarily out of generosity. The whole problem at the time was there was concerns that as HIV AIDS was ravaging the continent of Africa, that this was going to badly affect African security, that there would be many men and to some degree women in the prime of their lives that were being killed by the virus. And the Bush administration was worried that this would create all kinds of instability in Africa. So they decided to fund this huge global health initiative, PEPFAR, which has been really successful in saving, they think, somewhere around 25 million people by providing really vital medication and support. And so with the cutting of USAID, which works in partnership with PEPFAR and other organizations, this puts this all into disarray, into question. I mean, you have South Africa. Ironically, you know that's where Elon Musk is from, and he seems to have a vendetta against his own country. And you have over 8 million people who are HIV positive, and they just abruptly stopped these programs that were providing life-saving medicines. So, you know, Elon Musk said that this USAID was dead. It needed to be destroyed. But there was almost no thought put into what the health ramifications would be.
If we look at, you did rightly mention, you know, the bulk of the funding lies in the US, about 18%, you mentioned, of the total funding. But we could also look at, from Trump's first administration, the way he was hammering on, if you look at NATO and saying, you know, the NATO countries are not paying enough of the 2%. I think it's been raised to 5% now. And so what I guess the question is, what about other about the EU or the, does that now open, what is the percentage of their funding to Africa? And does this create alternative? Does it create opportunity for them to step up? And have they stepped up to this challenge?
Right. So there is opportunity, I guess, for European countries to step up. Whether they're going to do that I don't know, because they're also being bogged down by aid that needs to go to Ukraine as they're trying to stave off Russian aggression there. And the burden has been placed on European countries. I mean, typically what developed countries are supposed to spend on foreign aid is supposed to be 0.7% of their GNP. And the US spends like, 0.2%, something along those lines. So way under. You have some of the Scandinavian countries that are spending more than 0.7% of their GNP. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that their economies, though they are strong economies, they are much smaller countries with much smaller economies. So that amount of spending is going to pale in comparison to what a big country like the US with the biggest economy in the world is going to be able to spend on some of these programs. Some of the Scandinavian donors, Norway, Sweden in particular, to some degree Denmark, have been involved in the aid business. In some way, it is a bit of a business. So there is a donor community there, but it will not be really enough that's needed. I mean, there's two views on this, that aid isn't good, that it leads to aid dependence. And then the other view that's held by Jeffrey Sachs is that actually there just hasn't been enough aid to really make much of a difference. And so now we're entering a period where there's just going to be a huge vacuum.
You've mentioned Scandinavian countries. We've recently just had one of the episodes where they're kind of like reviving, setting up Denmark. I think Denmark, Norway, Sweden. They formed this kind of partnership with Africa and trying to like increase on a diplomatic level. But you just mentioned something about aid dependency. So the those that are against aid, foreign aid, might say, listen, foreign aid itself creates what you've just mentioned, dependency. And you also mentioned, which ties into what I've been doing, where it could inadvertently, or in some cases, you know, deliberately embolden authoritarian regimes. We've seen this maybe in Rwanda and Uganda, where these regimes are maybe involving maybe the EU or US counterterrorism programs, and then they get military aids, and then they've turned a blind eye to maybe the human rights violations that these countries. So do you think this is a good thing when we look at it in that light?
So I think there's definitely room for criticism of foreign aid and the way it's been handled in the past. I mean, you rightly mentioned the example of Rwanda, who is a darling of the aid community, led by Paul Kagame, who's been basically a dictator for now decades and is able to say the right things to the donors. And while they turned a blind eye to the fact that the country has become increasingly authoritarian. I mean, I have a student from Rwanda, and she can't go back to Rwanda. I mean, she'd say it's not a place where she would be able to live due to the human rights abuses that are taking place. So I think a lot of aid donors turned a turn a blind eye to this pretty frequently if they feel like they have the right man or woman at the helm, and they feel like they can work with them. It's a very slippery slope and sort of like a tight rope that you're walking between aid donors telling the recipients what to do all the time and trying to offer support. I mean, to me, in the case studies that I've looked at, foreign aid works best when it is bottom up, meaning the requests are coming from grassroots local actors that know exactly what they need, and then the aid is there to help them with these projects, and or there to help build some capacity. Foreign aid doesn't tend to work very well when it's very top down. It's sort of dictated, you do this, and these are the conditions, and then it sets up room for autocratic-like leaders to say, okay, yeah, sure, I'm going to do it, and then do whatever they feel like. Or even worse, in my opinion, when the aid is given without any consideration about what the local needs are, and then it ends up being a failure. And then often you'll see government ministers that are more distracted with all the forms that they have to fill out to deal with their donors, to please the donors, all the paperwork, all the bureaucracy, that they're not able to actually administer their own projects. So, I mean, there's a lot of criticism that I have of foreign aid, but yet at the same time, I do think that that doesn't mean we don't give any foreign aid. I think it's actually important to just think about ways to do it better.
I think that is a dilemma that I've been looking at in a number of years, that like how, because it will be, I think in my opinion, it would be very naive to assume that foreign aid is done without interest. There is strategic interest. And like you rightly mentioned, the George Bush administration paper was based on how that could destabilize, you know, global security. So it wasn't an altruistic motivation. So there's no aid that is altruistic, in my own opinion. So it's all about balancing that interest, where balancing the interest of the recipients. How can we balance that interest? Because I think, first of all, we need to acknowledge and admit as an interest, which is what donors do not, maybe in my opinion, do not admit. But we need to kind of admit that interest. But how do we balance that interest with the needs of the locals?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think that foreign aid can be mutually beneficial. So you could have an ulterior motive that benefits you, whether it be when you feel that you need to, you're trying to provide aid to stem the spread of an infectious disease. And maybe you're only doing it because you're worried about it spreading elsewhere. But then at the same time, you're also stemming the spread of the infectious disease in the local area. So it can be mutually beneficial to both. It's possible that the motives aren't entirely generous, but that the outcome is a public good that is provided to the recipient. I think where problems arise is where the recipient is left off way worse off, whether they be facing all kinds of debt, whether they be seeing much of their economy under the control of foreign actors, that somehow suddenly happens, as we've seen with some of the initiatives from China, or the same with the U.S. and other Western countries that have exploited the developing world, taken control over some sectors of the economy, and not pass on the benefits to local actors. I mean, it's important that any kind of aid can somehow benefit and lift both boats at the same time.
Speaking of that, you mentioned China now, and we've seen a lot of China's investment in you know, aids in Africa under its Belt and Road Initiative. How does that measure compare to Western donor over the years? Because it seems that, you know, does it have the same, because it looks like it's more, Africans kind of prefer more Chinese type kind of like aid, but experts have warned as well that has a long-term serious impact on the economic development in Africa. I don't know.
China now has a huge, in some ways they control quite a bit of the of African economies because of all this investment that they've provided that appears to come with no strings attached, but where Chinese investment has made huge inroads, where they control some sectors of the economies. And they've done similar things in Latin America. I think you could make the argument that there's not necessarily a huge difference between, if you look historically speaking, between the impact of US aid and Chinese aid or Western aid, that particularly because Western countries have been very neocolonial with both Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa, that, you know, there are always these strings attached where the beneficiary is the Western countries. And that's similar to the motivations that are driving Chinese investment. That though it may appear that there's no strings attached, there are. I think some of the things I have concerns about with in the case of China, and that's not to let go some of the things that Western countries have done and some of the abuse. But most of my concerns are that, you know, it's an authoritarian regime that has been actively selling technology that's being used for surveillance and to spy on, you know, country's own citizens. And it really limits free will and human rights. And I see that trend as particularly concerning.
When we talk about the impact, I know we did in the spat between South African Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, did say, you know, we don't depend much on aid. It's just that he in a HIV program. So is there a regional disparity in Africa where some countries are more affected than others with this aid, foreign aid, and the cutting of the aid?
For certain. I mean, South Africa obviously is a major economy. It's a huge economic powerhouse in Africa. And they, you know, they do, I would agree, they do depend on that PEPFAR program because it's already in place. But they probably could have the ability to phase that out had that been an option. You have though some other countries that are, I mean, let's just look at the DRC, which is one of the top USAID recipients dealing with the conflict, really dire levels of poverty and instability, you know, foreign interference, potential for disease spread, having dealt with Ebola multiple times and other infectious diseases. And I mean, the world has mostly abandoned the Congo for the most part. But where, you know, they the little aid they do get is vital to saving some lives there. So it just depends quite a bit on the strength of some of these local economies. But for some, it's really a matter of life and death, where you had USAID, if we just even not speaking about health, looking at preventing famines or identifying where there could be a famine or responding to a natural disaster. I mean, USAID in last year responded to over 84 natural disasters. So for a country that's really, really deeply impoverished and might not have the response capacity, what we're talking about is really saving lives. Though we don't wanna, perpetuate aid dependence indefinitely. If there has been a crisis where people are starving, you would think that you would want to have some kind of response team that can help support local actors in ensuring that that you don't have millions of people dying.
Very interesting. We've seen the African Union itself, or the African themselves, have been looking to, you know, the African solutions for African problem, the sort of, do you think this can help to hasten that process or help them start thinking towards that line?
So I completely agree with the idea that local actors, as I mentioned, I think local actors know the most about what they need. They can work in partnership with other actors. There can be a sharing of best practices, but we've seen this particularly with agriculture and like just thinking about like the greening of the Sahel, which has been a major initiative that was led by local African farmers. And it's been a huge success, as they use their local knowledge and share it and spread it. And then they got some support from African regional actors and other international organizations. Where you have this bottom-up-led ideas, initiatives, they're most likely to be successful because people on the ground know the most about what their needs are. We've seen the failure of World Bank initiatives time and time again that were really top-down and were telling people what to do, how you do this and this, because we saw it work in this other country. I mean, these types of initiatives have been colossal failures. So I see it incredibly important that local actors are involved in these kinds of processes and decision making.
Sometimes we talk about at the governmental level or intergovernmental level, there are other kind of like aids. So I'll take Mozambique as an example. So where there's some kind of like controversy and arbitration going on at the international level, where some bank, I think some Swiss bank, have given some sort of loan or money to the government to do some program, and it's ended up in private pockets. So how do you see that in the scale of aids or loan to Africa? When we look at, do you think some private companies or banks, international multilateral organizations that are not necessarily at the governmental level, how do you see them compared to are we showing more light to them? To these kind of like setups.
So, and if I understand your question correctly, are you asking me about what role the private sector plays?
Yes. We're private sectors. What role they play as well?
So I'm not against the private sector playing a role in helping local businesses thrive and help stimulate economic development. What I find concerning, and this happened in Mozambique a long time ago, but there were continues to be an issue where you have foreign multinationals that come in, take control over certain parts of the economy, and the benefits aren't really passed on to local citizens. Instead, they're hiring expats and so forth, and it's a perpetuation of you could make the argument neocolonialism, but it skews whatever economic growth that seems to be generating, that the country seems to be generating. It's actually just being concentrated in the hands of a few foreign actors that can quickly leave and take that capital with them when they feel that they don't want to be there anymore. We've seen this as a major problem in Latin America, but definitely also in sub-Saharan Africa as well. And so I think that corporations, multinationals, I mean, they have a lot of responsibility that when they are operating, you know, outside in different contexts in the global South, how are they lifting up all citizens? How are they using local actors? Or are they coming in, bringing in expats, inflating salaries, inflating the cost of living in certain places, and not really adding any kind of value? So thus far, we haven't really regulated this particularly well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I know, but then again, we've been looking over the years, the argument has been trade for aid. But then again, people would then argue that the imbalance in trade is African countries are kind of like extractive industries, distance and all. So how can Africa move from aid to trade? How can they move there? Because it seems that many African countries are looking to change the dynamics between, you know, how they deal with externals. How is that realistic? Is that even realistic?
I mean, that's such a good question. And a dilemma that I don't think there's a really an easy fix for, that there are unfair terms of trade, that trade is not fair, that the costs or the revenues that you gain from some of your exports, if you're like a coffee producer, a sugar producer, producing cocoa, you know, the terms of trade are completely unfair for these producers. And because African economies were restructured along the lines of what the colonial powers wanted them to be around, and they stopped actually engaging in, you know, clever forms of subsistence farming, and then suddenly you have a country like Burundi where almost all of its revenues are coming from producing coffee, and they got to compete with Brazil, which is the biggest coffee producer in the world, they then become really vulnerable anytime there is a crop failure or there's a dump of coffee on the world market. So I think it's important for African economies, particularly in agriculture, to be able to produce particularly agricultural products that are in sync with what the environment and the climate can produce. Like, you hear some success stories about moringa plants or baobab powder, and that there are specific plants that are more unique to Africa that that offer a higher value, that they could focus more on diversification and ignore the years and years of the IMF telling them that they have to develop an economy of scale in one big, you know, agricultural export or a few industries. But then where I see the internal thing is to address corruption. And, you know, that takes a long time to do. But, you know, there's a clear correlation, right, between states that are less corrupt, then they can really focus on targeting industries that will, you know, lead to economic growth. And so the world's responsibility of making fair terms of trade, and there's all kinds of other things, obviously, the West could be doing, which I won't get into, as I've already been going on for a while, but just looking at corruption.
Yeah, but speaking of that, I think the next question will be, what is the short, medium-term implications of this? Because it does seem as well that there might be some positive that might come out from this. Because if you look at what you're talking about, it may then lead people to start looking at what unique advantage that, like some of the things you've mentioned. But then again, if you also mentioned corruption, and one of the arguments has been foreign aid corrupt the leaders in a way. So I guess the question is, what is the short, medium and long-term implication of this policy, of this freeze, in the negative, both negative and the positive?
So I think that I could have gotten on board with a gradual reduction of aid had it been planned out with local actors. How are you going to do it? This is how, you know, this is what the plan is in place. What I don't find very helpful is that it was just done so abruptly. And that kind of left people who, like clinics where there were just doctors and nurses that then are suddenly seeing that their patients, you know, don't have access to vital medication, and that these clinics are shut down at a time when people need them. And that's not a really good strategy. So in the short term, you're going to have casualties. And I find that to be probably the saddest thing about this. If it had been done with a long-term view, that you try to empower capacity of local actors, build capacity, then that takes time to build, but it is possible. And we've seen, you know, countries like Botswana have grown in their capacity levels since their independence, building the state. They're able to, I mean, they were hit really hard by the AIDS crisis, but they were able to enhance their own capacity to address it and saw HIV deaths go down significantly. So it's totally possible. But you're right that though I would agree that the current aid business sometimes helps dictators and keeps them in power and props them up, I would argue against the solution being let's just scrap all the aid at once. I think it would be better to think of more about how we can do this in a long-term way that would be dictated by local actors about what would be the best way of doing it.
One of the things that you mentioned, Botswana, and in my book, when I was looking at the legacy of colonialism and looking at state formation, and so Botswana does seems to be uniquely different from many African states in terms of its composition. And some have argued, some, I can't remember some of the scholars, and have argued that is why he's been able to have the kind of development success that he's had because of his, you know, colonization that is different in terms of the homogeneity of his, maybe the people, the language, and stuff like that. So I don't know, because a lot of old scholars have seen that partly is the state composition of African states that is holding them down. But I've also looked at, we can always keep referencing that, even though it's partly so. So I guess the question is, to begin to wrap up is, how do we, I think let me ask this question. So to just take a broad look, what is the future? Because we can't help but looking at what is this future, because this is the reality now. If Trump is able to do this, so what is the future? We cannot abandon all of this critical infrastructure. So what is the future going to look like? Future of Africa and international, as Africa is becoming more critical when it comes to, you know, geopolitics and trying to restructure its relationship. So what do you, how do you see Africa in the nearest future, maybe 10 years from now, whatever, in terms of?
That's a great question. Hard to answer. Hard to answer in a few minutes. I would say that Africa should use this as opportunity to become even more united as a region, that they're going to have to. I mean, Europe is going to have to do as well, as they're dealing with Trump, who I see as a huge menace to the world. And regions will have to increase their levels of integration, or at least try to be more united and on the same page about responding as a bloc and about promoting what African interests are. And maybe that is going to expedite or facilitate this. Because often there have been internal divisions. It's understandable, because Africa is such a diverse continent, just not diverse as a continent, but diverse even within cities, within countries, and so forth, within regions. But there hopefully might be a unifying force here. I myself am Panamanian American. I'm hoping that Latin America responds in a similar fashion, that, you know, as Trump's threatening to take the Panama Canal, which is creating a lot of havoc in Panama, and threatening to slap, you know, tariffs on Mexico, on Colombia, on whoever, I'm hoping that regions really take this as a moment to not cower to Trump, to not kiss up to him, to not placate him, to unite and try to provide, you know, more safety in numbers, a more united force in dealing with him.
That's very amazing. Well, Natisha, this is very amazing. So I'm really, really grateful for this very rich insight and views. So and I do agree with you. You know, it has to be a concerted effort to stand up against I call undemocratic. We need to push that. It needs to be pushed.
Trump against this guy. He's awful. And I'm hoping, you know, even though I grew up in the U.S., I'm hoping everybody just bans against him and isolates him.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree. But anyways, we thank you very much for your time and your support.
Yeah, thank
and,
you either way.
All right. Thank you very much, Natisha. We really appreciate it. And have a very great weekend.
You too. Thanks so much. It was a great conversation. Really good questions. And please stay in touch.
Yeah, I will. Thank you. I'll definitely stay in touch for
yeah,
for
yeah. The just keep me in the loop of what you're doing. It sounds like you're doing a lot of really interesting work.
Yeah, I will. I will definitely. You have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning in today to another exciting episode. As usual, join me to thank our guest, our Professor Natisha Lindstedt, for her insight into the Trump's administration suspension of foreign aid and how that can galvanize and spark some sort of response or concerted effort from African countries, and help them to some kind of independence. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.